This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman. Alzheimer's is a disease that robs millions of people of the past, present, and future, and also places a great burden on caregivers. Coming up this hour, we'll look at what we know about Alzheimer's disease with Miami University Department of Sociology and Gerontology Assistant Professor Dr. Kate Medeiros, and also Professor Dr. Jennifer Kenney. Dr. Medeiros and Dr. Kenney are both research fellows at the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami. Also joining us on the phone is filmmaker Scott Kirschenbaum. His groundbreaking documentary, You're Looking at Me Like I Live Here and I Don't, was filmed entirely in an Alzheimer's care unit, told from the perspective of an Alzheimer's patient. You can join our conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Coming up later this hour in an interview, we'll hear from an author about Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. And Kate, I'm sorry, I think I messed up your name, even though I wrote it down.
De Medeiros.
I knew when it came out, I didn't think I had it exactly right. Well, Scott, since we have you on the phone, let's start with you about your documentary. I read in some notes that were provided to me that originally you wrote a screenplay that you were going to film in an Alzheimer's unit, and you were working on rehearsals. And as you were doing that, you said that you realized you were making the wrong film. So tell me what you started out to do, why you decided that was wrong, and what you ended up doing.
Sure, yeah. My background is in screenwriting, actually, and I had put together a whole screenplay that I set out to film at this nursing home facility just outside of Oakland. And when I got to that space with a production team of over 20 people, I suddenly realized it was just too challenging to explore a narrative screenplay instead of focusing on the reality of the environment. And so I quickly switched over to this documentary structure, and fortunately I had kind of the perfect muse in the subject of this film, Lee Gorowitz.
And tell us how you met Lee.
She pretty much accosted me when I walked through the door at the facility. I mean, right when I walked in, she took me by the arm and started walking me around the unit and explaining things to me. And, you know, obviously it was difficult to follow her because of the disease and the difficulties she has in putting together sentences sometimes. But we hit it off immediately, and she kind of was my best friend in that space.
And originally you almost thought that she was a staff member?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I mistook her for a recreation and therapeutic director of the facility. I mean, I've been to a lot of nursing homes around the country, and I walked in, and she was just so bubbly and alive, and it was exciting to get to know her.
And then you spent the next 6 months with her, correct, to do the documentary?
Yeah, well, before we even filmed, a group of friends and I who were working on this project would go there about three or four times a week to spend time with the residents and participate in a number of the activities. And during that time, I would particularly focus on Lee and my rapport with Lee. And then once the children of the residents there gave us their blessing to film this project, we actually filmed over the span of 2 weeks, about 4 or 5 years ago from today.
And what does the documentary show? What's your goal with the documentary?
Sure. I would say that this project endeavors to reveal Lee's world, her experience in the Alzheimer's unit, and to tell her story from her perspective without relying on, you know, sort of outside narration like conversation from doctors or family members. It's very much focused on Lee's relationship with the other 19 residents of this Alzheimer's and other dementia unit.
What did this process mean to you?
I can't say enough about what I've learned from my experience in that space, especially from the residents. You know, you learn a lot about empathy and about how to connect with people when language is not available. And, you know, in college, I focused a lot on subjects that involved elderly individuals and nursing home themes. And just to be able to have the blessing and permission to film in this space and to see the film received such a strong reception around the country has been incredible.
You, one of the other notes that you said that for Lee, as for many in an Alzheimer's unit, every day is an odyssey. Describe what you mean by an odyssey.
I once heard a researcher tell me that having Alzheimer's at times could be like waking up in Russia and not speaking any Russian and not knowing, you know, where you're supposed to go through the day. And, you know, fortunately there are caregivers around to help aid the residents, but to me, when you see an individual in that space, wake up and just try to figure out how to go about the day, what is a safe and healthy routine, and how to interact with the other residents. It's really profound and incredible just to see the functionality on a daily basis in that environment. And, you know, it's amazing to see a number of the caregivers and doctors and what kind of kindness and generosity they offer to the residents.
We are discussing Alzheimer's today on Cincinnati Edition. If you have a question or comment or a story that you'd like to share, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org. We're all talking about the documentary, You Were Looking at Me Like I Live Here, and I Don't Guest Here, from the research fellows with the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami. Dr. Kenney, tell me just a little bit about the Gerontology Center. What do you do?
Scripps Gerontology Center was actually founded in 1922 by E.W. Scripps. He traveled the world and became aware of the fact that demography really matters. He saw people getting older, living longer, and just realized that we should be paying attention to population worldwide. And so we started out as a demography center, but over time, in the 1970s, increasingly we became aware of the fact that not only does demography matter, how many people are born, die, how many people move into an area, how many people move out of an area, that matters. But what was really interesting is the fact that people were living longer and longer and longer. And so in the 1970s, the focus of the center shifted from demography in general to really emphasize aging-related issues. There's still a strong demography focus, but through the center staff as well as faculty members throughout Miami University who are interested in aging-related issues, we all conduct research at the center. And we view aging as a lifelong process. It's not just studying older people, but it's studying people throughout their lives so that we can understand how people age, how they grow older. And we're interested in what impact older adults have on society, but also how the society in which we grow up and grow old influences what that experience is like.
When was the first time we heard the term Alzheimer's? I mean, how long have we been talking about Alzheimer's disease?
Actually, the coin was termed in 1906 by Dr. Alois Alzheimer, who described symptoms that he saw in a patient. And what happened was that's the person who's given credit for first identifying it. He actually described odd behavior in someone who was relatively young. She was in her early to mid-50s. And Kate, you want to elaborate at all?
No, it's just that at the time, Alzheimer's didn't associate this disease with aging. So because it was a younger woman, he knew that there were some abnormalities, and upon brain autopsy, noticed the tangles and the plaques that are really hallmarks of the disease. So it wasn't until much later that people started applying that concept to late life dementia, and the term Alzheimer's then being applied to that group.
And I think it's really important to point out that right now in the general media, there's a lot of confusion about what Alzheimer's disease is. And so we have things like the National Alzheimer's Association. I think it's really important to realize that Alzheimer's disease is one particular type of dementia. There are other types of dementia. And while medical researchers are working to figure out those different types, social scientists, people who are interested in the humanities are trying to figure out what we can do here today to facilitate the process of living with one of these diseases.
And I think I saw Alzheimer's, though, is the most prominent type of dementia. Is that correct?
It's the most common. So it's estimated that of all the dementias, 70% are of the Alzheimer's type. However, a person can also have an Alzheimer's type and vascular dementia. So it's not mutually exclusive. So you could actually have more than one type of dementia. And that ends up being relevant in terms of ways that people might act in public or in private, whether they're responsive to certain types of therapies. So you would see somebody with an Alzheimer's type dementia behaving often very differently than somebody with, say, a vascular dementia or a Lewy bodies dementia.
Could you describe both of those, the vascular and the last one that you mentioned?
The vascular dementia would be caused by, something in the brain, a mini stroke, some kind of a, vascular issue. So it could damage a different part of the brain. Say if the front part of your brain, your frontal temporal lobe is damaged, it helps. That's what filters out your inhibitions. So somebody could have a very disinhibited behavior if they had that part of their brain damaged. Alzheimer's dementia, people generally are very in tune with social interactions. So as you saw, as you'll see in the documentary, many of the people still are able to have conversations. They still behave like you normally would. And I use the word normal loosely, but maybe with loss of language. So you see people having conversations. A Lewy body dementia is associated with a Parkinsonian etiology. Not that people with Parkinson's will get this type of dementia, but there is a close relationship. So you might see people with Lewy bodies dementia having severe hallucinations and delusions, having problems with movements and other things, which is really different than the other two types.
My grandfather was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I want to say, in the late 80s, early 90s. And it seemed to me then that was the first time that I had heard of that. Now, was that because I was sheltered, or was that when it was starting to be more of a term that people were using?
It was a time when really awareness was starting. I think it used to be assumed that all older people would suffer from cognitive decline, and so it wasn't necessarily considered a problem, and still isn't in many places in the world. It's just assumed to be something that just happens. And so it wasn't until people really started raising awareness and focusing research that they could distinguish that this isn't an inevitable part of aging. It's something different that happens.
Well, I think it came to the attention of the public really when former President Reagan made the announcement that he had Alzheimer's disease. And I think that became a rallying event among people who are interested in this disease. But as Dr. DiMedeiros pointed out, we grow old. Not all of us will get Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia, and that a lot of the cognitive impairments we experience as part of normal aging are relatively minor and really don't become issues until probably our 80s.
And still no idea, research continues on what causes these issues?
No, yes, there's still one of the sayings is that we're nowhere close, but we could find something tomorrow, meaning that right now there are a lot of therapies aimed at, say, the plaques and the tangles and hypotheses that if we could get rid of those, we would treat the disease. But in reality, it's not well understood why they develop to begin with, when they develop, if they are a product of the disease or something else. And so we're really at a pretty much of a standstill. You'll see in the news every now and then mice trials where they'll come up with something that looks hopeful, but sadly those really don't progress beyond the first stage of experimentation, and there, it's hotly debated, even as to whether Alzheimer's is a disease or not, or if it's a constellation of symptoms. So it's like I say, we could find something tomorrow, but right now it's not looking very promising in the near future anyway.
What kind of funding is available for research? I mean, I hear people talk about cancer research. I know former basketball coach Jim Valvano said that there wasn't near enough money for cancer research. Where does Alzheimer's research compare, say, with like cancer research?
I guess there are different types of research. So just like there's the National Cancer Society who funds some types of cancer research, there's the Alzheimer's Association and the Alzheimer's Federation, both who provide some funding. There's also funding at the National Institutes of Health who have some money dedicated to looking at different types of cognitive decline. And there certainly are pharmaceutical companies who are doing a lot of research. So, you know, some would argue that there's not enough. Others would argue that there's too much. So depends on what side of the fence you stand on, I think.
Well, and I think that in addition to that, it's important to point out that there are different kinds of research. So while there are people working on trying to understand the mechanisms of the disease and figure out if this is even a disease. There's other kinds of research that focuses on trying to provide an optimal quality of life for people who are living with the disease and their families. And so there's bench science going on, but there's also a wealth of research looking at the environment and how can we create environments that foster positive interactions for people. And I think that's a really important point that we oftentimes think about finding the cure, but while some researchers are working toward that, other researchers are working toward quality of life right now.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're discussing Alzheimer's disease, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. If you have a question, 513-419-7100. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman. We're discussing Alzheimer's disease today with Miami University Department of Sociology and Gerontology Assistant Professor Dr. Kate DiMedeiros and Professor Dr. Jennifer Kenney. Also on the phone with us is filmmaker Scott Kirschenbaum, who has a new documentary, You're Looking at Me Like I Live Here and I Don't, and that's going to be shown in the Cincinnati area on April the 29th. We'll have some more information about that at the end of the program. You'll also find links about that on our website, wvxu.org. If you have a question, 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Again, 513-419-7100. And Rebecca is on the line from Finneytown. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
I have two questions / comments. My grandfather died with Alzheimer's, and my father has dementia, so my sister and I constantly wonder if we're doomed, to the same fate. And number two, my father is an identical twin. My father has dementia, but his twin has Parkinson's. And I've read some studies or histories that's common in identical twins. I wondered if your guest knew anything about that. And also for Scott, the filmmaker, thank you very much for what you've done. I can't wait to see it. Alzheimer's is a very cruel, horrible disease to watch and experience. So thank you very much for doing that.
Who wants to tackle her question?
Well, this is Kate DiMedeiros, regards to your question about whether you and your sister are doomed to Alzheimer's, the evidence would say no, that's not necessarily the case. Even in families where both parents have Alzheimer's, it doesn't mean that the child will have it, or in cases where neither parent has it, it doesn't mean the child will not have it. The only real link is in early onset Alzheimer's, and if you have a genetic predisposition, which testing can be done, it's a very particular kind of Alzheimer's that tends to hit people in their 40s or 50s, so not typical at all. So with regards to that, no, it's not well understood, but it does not necessarily mean that you and your sister are definitely susceptible.
I do think, though, if a family has those concerns, that's a really good opportunity to start having conversations while you can. So, for example, if your sister and you are really worried about this, it makes sense to start thinking about, if I were to experience cognitive decline later, what would I want my life to look like? What plans would I want in place for myself? And I think it gives us an opportunity, as hard as it is to think about this, to do some planning for the future just in case it does happen.
What testing-wise would be available if somebody, like you said, you can plan for it, but is there a way to know?
Only for the early onset, and it's the APOE4 allele, a genetic marker, that there's a test, and you have to have both.
I'm assuming that would be some sort of blood test?
Yes, and then you'd have to have a positive on both sides, and all of this is a bit controversial, but for the typical type of Alzheimer's that hits people with older age, there is no blood test per se, or there's nothing that's, I mean, there's a lot of trials going on, but there's nothing that's definitive.
Scott, the caller there, thanked you for your documentary. What kind of reaction have you got from families of Alzheimer's patients to the documentary?
It's been just incredibly positive. The movie aired originally on PBS's program, Independent Lens, and since then I've pretty much received, email correspondences on a weekly basis from caregivers and from facilities that have been utilizing the film, along with some professors and researchers. So I'm quite overjoyed that people have responded this way, and it's a testament to Lee and her her spirit.
What surprised you the most when you were filming your documentary?
Just how, I guess, spontaneous and improvisational I had to be with my process because of the sort of energy in an Alzheimer's unit. You never know what's going to happen, and you really have to go with the flow. So it was a really fun process, and you laughed a lot, and there were obviously some sad moments, but it was just incredible to try to navigate that environment and come up with some larger structure for a documentary.
Let's talk about some of the symptoms. I know there was some documents that were given to me. Everybody has things where they forget. Where did I leave my car keys? Or even this morning driving in, I was trying to remember somebody's last name. And I thought, and what we're talking about today. But what are things when you should start to be concerned?
It's often not the person themselves that notices it. So first of all, memory loss is normal as we age, and word finding is the first thing that people notice. So most people get upset when they can't remember the name of an actor or, something like that. And that's perfectly normal, and that happens, and that's not an indication of any kind of dementia. But often people with dementia themselves may start to get extremely paranoid. Maybe they feel that their loved ones are hiding things or purposely withholding things from them because they can't simply remember. So some people lack a sense of insight of their own memory loss, whereas other people may be aware of, I'm really having a hard time. And in that case, testing is the best thing. And, I would really suggest also not simply talking to your family care physician, who may or may not have a lot of training in this, but if you're really concerned, going to see a neuropsychiatrist, a neurologist, somebody who's really, really well skilled and has the ability to test a variety of memory aspects is the thing to do.
Well, and also, I sometimes can't find the word I want, and I don't get too worried about that because other things can contribute to that kind of memory loss. You could be tired, you could be stressed out, you could be trying to do too many things at once. And so what I usually recommend people, and I'm not a clinician, I'm a social science researcher, but when I talk with people about this, I encourage them to think about the magnitude of the forgetting. So for example, and I'm not making light of this at all, but I have a grandparent who had a dementia of some sort. And he would make mistakes. Any one of us can forget to grab a coat if it's cold out. But the mistake he would make would be he would forget to get dressed before he went outside. And it's hard to not kind of laugh at that. It's a horrible thing to have happened to someone. But it's not normal forgetting. If you forget something but you can remember all the things you forgot, you probably don't need to worry. If you normally have been somebody who's very good at managing their checkbook and all of a sudden you look and the numbers are backwards and sideways and you can't make sense of it anymore, there's a magnitude of the forgetting that I think are the key triggers. And as Kate pointed out, it's oftentimes someone else who notices. And then you have to have that difficult conversation and pursue it to find out if something else is going on, because memory loss could be due to a metabolic imbalance, a nutritional deficiency, a host of things, a medication mismanagement issue. So there could be multiple things that cause forgetfulness.
How accepting? I know I said that my grandfather, had Alzheimer's. My stepdad was diagnosed too. And I know my mom and stepbrother had a terrible time. He wasn't accepting of that. They knew it, but he didn't know it. And one of the things that they had the hardest time doing was try to get him to stop driving, to the point that he had an accident. His vehicle, broke down in the middle of the road, and he just abandoned it. And those are difficult conversations to have. How do you begin that process?
Well, I think you start the conversation with the conversation about cognition and cognitive loss. But you have to keep in mind that if memory loss is one of the features of the illness, that it's often difficult for people to retain the memory of the conversation about the illness. So some strategies I've seen people use is that they'll have the physician write a letter with some simple explanation that they can keep referring to. This is the letter that your physician wrote. Remember, those kinds of things. Sometimes people have been effective in using trickery, I guess, for nothing else. So hiding the car keys and then mentioning that the car doesn't work anymore, those kinds of things to try to prevent those behaviors that are potentially dangerous. But you know, that's the challenge, that if somebody simply doesn't remember and they then think that maybe you might be telling them something purposely misleading, it can be a difficult thing to negotiate.
Do things, and I also noticed with him, things tend to be worse at night. He was not so bad in the daytime, but in the evening, you know, he would put on pajamas and go to bed at 7:30 and then be ready to go get out of bed like at 8:30 or 9:30, get dressed and be ready to go do something, even though he'd only been in bed for 2 hours. And you talk about the paranoia. I know his problem, he had a wallet that he hid in different places at nighttime because he was afraid that people were going to come in and take it. So each night it was in a different place.
Which makes it very hard to find it in the morning. And when you can't find your wallet, then you think
somebody's taken it.
So it's, I think that's a great explanation of how this oftentimes plays out. I think that one of the things that we can do is to really become knowledgeable about this disease. And there are great community resources. The Greater Cincinnati chapter of the Alzheimer's Association is a good resource. There are other community resources that help family navigate some of these transitions. And one of the things to think about is once you know what you're dealing with, and once you know that a person has a disease and these are the symptoms, this is what we have to work with, then I think the challenge becomes being really clever about how you work with those symptoms. Because if someone has a disease, no matter how many explanations you give, as Kate pointed out, they're not going to be able to remember. So the challenge becomes, how can we work with what abilities are still in place? How can we capitalize on that to make a day-to-day routine that works for both the person with the disease, but also their family members who are trying to also make that work?
We are discussing Alzheimer's disease, 513-419-7100. And Chuck from Hartwell, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Mine's more of a comment. I volunteered at hospices and my experience, and also with people who were on the staff there, they said that the most telltale sign of early Alzheimer's is the person asking the same question over and over again, even when you've given them the answer. And I can agree with that because I had the experience with my mother who died not too long ago from complications from Alzheimer's. So basically that was my comment.
We appreciate that. Thanks, Chuck. What I know, I think there was a drug a few years ago, and it may still be, but I think it was called Aricept, which, again, that doesn't treat the actual Alzheimer's, but it helps with the symptoms. What is available now in the form of medication to kind of deal with the symptoms of Alzheimer's?
That's really about it. There's Aricept and there's Namenda, which is often used in conjunction with Aricept. And basically, Aricept floods the brain with neurotransmitters. So whereas the brain is sending signals and through the disease process, the signals are no longer being captured, the theory behind Aricept is if we can suddenly flood it with signals, then more will get through. So what you see with people with Aricept is, and it only works in about a third of the folks who use it, is that they will have better functioning for a time, but the decline and the deterioration in the brain continues. So there's a point at which it's no longer effective. Sometimes they use Namenda along with that. Donepezil is the generic name, to help with some of the behaviors. So again, it's really looking at the brain chemistry and being able to modify some of the things like forgetfulness, but it really does nothing to stop or slow the disease process. And sadly, there's nothing that's made it through the clinical trial phase of any kind of treatment. So that's pretty much what's used right now.
Is there anything being worked on the horizon that you know that's going through the trial process?
There are all kinds of things. And, you know, there were for a while there was a lot of interest in looking at the immune response and different immunosuppressants and wondering what the link was. There was a vaccine you might remember from a few years ago that was being tried, but that ended up to not be effective. So there's all kinds of things in a phase two trial, phase one, but very, very few have made it through phase three. So I'm not aware of anything that's currently being used, but there's always something around the corner. Like I say, people feel that the breakthrough is going to come through very unexpectedly and very suddenly, so we can be hopeful that maybe tomorrow's the day, but that's about it.
What someone said to me one time when they were discussing Alzheimer's, and I don't want to oversimplify that, but it was sort of like use it or lose it, that if you keep your brain active doing things like, you know, crossword puzzles or challenges like that, that maybe that will make a difference. Is that true?
Actually, in 2010, the National Institutes of Health did a major review of all the research that had been done with NIH funding looking at possible treatments, prevention strategies for Alzheimer's disease. And what they found was that the things we can do to decrease the probability that we'll get the disease are things like eating properly, exercising, limiting our alcohol intake, and not smoking cigarettes. They looked at a host of factors that in the popular media had been talked about as being possible treatment strategies or things that could prolong the disease. Those didn't pan out. So things like vitamins and various supplements, those didn't seem to be effective. We do know that people who have diabetes, who smoke, who drink, are at greater risk of developing the disease. But these are based on research that's been done. This is a large body of research. And the only thing that the NIH study panel came up with were the things I mentioned earlier, the eating right, the exercising, and not smoking and drinking to excess.
What would be the proper diet then?
Well, that's hotly debated now, too. You've heard about the Mediterranean diet where, you know, the theory is that a little bit of red wine can help cut down fats, and that's certainly something that's being researched. We also have the whole idea of caloric restriction. I guess the take-home message is what Dr. Kinney said, and that's what's good for your heart is good for your brain. And so anything you can do to promote heart health will promote brain health. But what exactly that is, I think we can see that being debated now in the literature.
And actually, we probably should say it is much debated. There's a lot in the popular media right now about keeping active cognitively. And based on my review of the literature so far and going back to that NIH study panel, they really emphasize physical activity. But I think that I'm hedging my bets. I try to stay cognitively active, too.
You mentioned that this got a lot of publicity when Ronald Reagan came out. What about when former Tennessee women's basketball coach Pat Summitt came forward? Did that have an impact?
Yes. I think any time a public figure comes forward, it has an impact. And I think that she put a unique face on it because of her age. So she would be one of those people that were in the early onset category. So that's not a typical Alzheimer's. And again, early onset is when people are affected in their 40s and 50s. And it's a much more progressive type of the disease. And I think it's much more surprising when it happens since it is somebody so young. So I think she certainly raised a lot of awareness about that particular issue.
Scott, from your documentary, is there one moment or a scene that really stands out that will surprise people?
I would say that people would learn a lot about watching the residents eat meals together, and also just the shifts that residents experience emotionally through the course of the day. And of course, Lee was a prolific dancer, so I think people always get a kick out of watching her dance to Beyond the Sea in the movie.
I asked about Pat Summitt, and there was a line in some of the research that was given to me. And basically, the line was, women are at the epicenter of the Alzheimer's epidemic. Why is that? Do you know yet why it tends to affect women more than men?
Well, it's actually rather simple. Women outlive men. Age is the biggest risk factor. Therefore, you have more women who are older and therefore who are being affected. Also, as far as long-term care, women often are the care providers for their husbands. And so if their husbands precede them in death, then their care is up to either if they have children who are able to care for them or not. So they often find themselves in institutions towards the end of life for that reason as well.
This can also have a major economic impact on families. And we talked about earlier that if you thought, when the question was asked about, you know, how do you want to be cared for, but how important is it to have the conversation about planning for long-term care and to make that families have that conversation, which sometimes can be very difficult?
Those are really difficult conversations, and I think every family should be having them, whether there's a disease on the horizon or not. The reality is, if we're fortunate enough, we're all going to enter late life, and at some point, it's possible that we won't be able to care for ourselves. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately is we tend to talk about people being independent versus dependent. I think that in our culture, we draw these big lines about it's important to be independent, and we think of dependency as bad. And I think if we look realistically at what's happening in most of our families, we're really capitalizing on interdependence. Older people rely on younger people, but younger people are also relying on older people. And so I think that having those conversations and acknowledging that we are connected to one another within our families, within our communities, and figuring out how those interdependencies can be healthy is really important. So I'm a huge fan of having the conversations. And what I've found in my own family is the first time you start to have the conversation around the edges, it's difficult, but after that, it's easier.
We've been discussing Alzheimer's disease with Miami University Department of Sociology and Gerontology Assistant Professor Dr. Kate DeMedeiros, and also Professor Dr. Jennifer Kenney. Dr. DeMedeiros and Dr. Kenney are also both research fellows at the Scripps Gerontology Center at Miami. Filmmaker Scott Kirschenbaum joined us on the phone to talk about his groundbreaking documentary, You're Looking at Me Like I Live Here and I Don't, filmed entirely in an Alzheimer's care unit, told from the perspective of an Alzheimer's patient. Kirschenbaum will be in Cincinnati on April 29th for a free public screening of his documentary at Miami University's Voice of America Learning Center, followed by a panel discussion on Alzheimer's. Screening and discussion are presented by the Cedar Village Retirement Community and Miami University. And again, you'll find links to additional information on our website, wvxu.org. Coming up after the break, an interview with an author about Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.